Anybody feel your pulse in the tips of your fingers? Try it at home. It's not dangerous. It's kind of interesting. I'll introduce in the course of the semester a range of other meditative practices, just to add variety to what we do in class. All right. On with our, let's see. Why is this not? For some reason, my slides are not moving from one slide to another. There we go. Okay. So first, to summarize from the last lecture, and to remind you what the structure of this particular set of lectures is. Last lecture was an attempt at providing you with an account of how markets are supposed to work, which was also a defense of markets. It was laying out the virtues of markets that defenders of markets point to. At the end of the class, someone came up to me and said they were surprised that I was arguing for limited government, given what I had said in my introductory lectures. What I was giving you yesterday, or on Tuesday, was the argument for limited government. I, in fact, think we need an affirmative state, a state that intervenes quite broadly in the economy in order for the market to do what it's supposed to do. And that you can't just leave it up to markets. They won't behave properly if left up to their own devices. But I felt it was important to set up the discussion of my critical comments by giving the strongest defense possible, in my view, of what the virtues of the market are and why government regulation, government interference should be as little as possible. So the argument in the last lecture then revolved around the following points. First, four main virtues of markets. If markets behave like they're supposed to behave. First, freedom. Markets are an expression of the value of individual freedom. Exchanges are voluntary. Nobody is forced to do anything. You make your own choices, which is the heart of what freedom is all about. Second, coordination of complex systems. Markets accomplish a remarkable feat through supply, demand, and the price mechanism. And the main alternatives to that in a complex society, allocating resources by authoritative command, turns out to create all sorts of difficulties, has all sorts of problems, which markets do more easily. So markets provide extraordinarily complex coordination mechanisms in the kind of world in which we live. Third, efficiency. The argument is that unfettered markets result in allocative efficiency. Things are distributed across people as best as they possibly could be. They are Pareto optimal. You can't do any better. And the reasoning is that everybody's engaged in voluntary exchange, and when nobody has anything else to exchange voluntarily, it must be that if you force the redistribution, somebody would be made worse off. I used that little silly example of apples and oranges just to illustrate that idea. Free, voluntary, decentralized exchange creates allocative efficiency. And finally, dynamic efficiency, that is innovation and growth. Markets create strong incentives for risk-taking and innovation. And that is indeed one of the great virtues of capitalist markets, and it's at the heart of why capitalism has been historically such a dynamic system. And then I raised at the end of the lecture, in perhaps a bit of a hurried way, arguments in favor of the free market against government regulation. If we believe in these virtues of markets, why we should also believe, the argument goes, in limited government. You know, the aphorism, that government governs best which governs least. The argument for a limited government. First, there's the moral issue. State regulation is an affront to freedom. All state regulations coercively impose restrictions on what people can do. And therefore, you should be extremely hesitant to have any government regulation because in and of itself, quite apart from any other problems, it goes against that core value, the value of freedom. And secondly, there are these pragmatic questions. Even if you think there's no problem, it would be a good thing in principle for government to intervene and regulate, it just doesn't work. It does a bad job. And it does a bad job of it for two kinds of reasons. One is just incompetence. And the other, which is a little more, it's a little darker, is malevolence. In Trump's inaugural address, he was basically attacking the malevolence of government when he said that Washington enriched itself at the expense of the people. That idea that the result of the last 30 years or so of government regulation has been an enrichment of Washington at the expense of ordinary people, that the redistribution that we see in high inequality in the United States is from the people to Washington rather than from the people to corporations or to the rich, is the particular claim that Trump was making in his attack on what he called the establishment, by which he just meant the Washington establishment. He didn't mean the economic elite, he meant the political elite. Well, that's malevolence. That's saying that government regulations claim to be in the interests of people. Environmental regulations are claims to be in the interest of a clean environment for the health of people, but actually the purpose of regulations is to secure the jobs of people in the environmental regulation industry, in government, and to enrich them. That's the malevolence argument. Okay, those are the arguments in favor of the market and against what I call the affirmative state, a state that actively intervenes to solve problems. Three themes, we will explore three themes in the next two lectures, this lecture and the one next week. First, how well does the free market perform around its core moral value, freedom? First thing we'll interrogate is this. Whoops. Now why? Was that also off on the last slide? Tell me when things like that happen, because I'm looking this way. Those are the two little girls are now in their late 30s. We lived with another family when they were that age. He is now a high-powered computer jock at Google in Silicon Valley. The little one with the stuff on her head, she's a theater director in Philadelphia. And the one in the middle lives in Australia, unfortunately. All right, let me see why we are not getting why do I have trouble with this? And the people who came before, and it was on before. What I don't understand is why I get let's see. Maybe this will do it. Let's see if does duplicate do it? Yeah. Okay.
It may be worth. I think if we do this, it'll put on the other screen too.
Right, but I wanted people looking.
Oh. Okay.
That's why I. Whoops. I was wanting to not have both screens just because. You think it'll go back up on its own? All right. Well, by the end of the semester, we'll have all these systems down perfect. All right. Are we still? Okay, that's jumping ahead a bit. Okay, here we go. That was what I just said. By the way, as I've told you, the slides are all available. Now I'm going to push that guy up, and I'm going to close that. The slides are all available online, so you can download them at your will. All right, that's the list of points I just went through. The three themes we're going to deal with. First, this: how well does the market do even on its core value, freedom? Secondly, we'll investigate these pragmatic issues. How well does the market do with respect to its claims about efficiency and related matters? These are referred to as market failures. And third, we'll look at the way in which markets impact non-market social interactions and social values. Do unregulated markets have a corrosive effect on other kinds of values that are not themselves directly connected to the market, but which we might care about a lot? So first, markets and freedom. At the heart of this discussion, then, is a distinction between two kinds of freedom, which I briefly described in the previous lecture. Negative freedom is freedom from. No one can physically force you to do anything. Positive freedom is freedom to, the actual capacity to do things, to realize your goals. I think most people intuitively hold both ideas. People both want to not have to ask permission when they want to do things. They want to be able to do things through their own choices. But they also want to have the real capacity to do those things. To be deprived of the capacities to act really undermines the notion that you have choices. That's the relationship between positive and negative freedom. Well, the strong suit of markets is negative freedom. The market is a pretty good institution, all things considered, for partially realizing negative freedom. No one really forces you to buy something. And again, as I mentioned and briefly in passing in the discussion on Tuesday, this is why the idea of an individual mandate in health insurance, forcing people to buy health insurance, seemed so at odds. It seemed like such a violation of freedom, precisely because buying things are the things you're supposed to do just on the basis of your own autonomous preferences. Even though, as I mentioned, I don't think anyone objects to forcing car owners to be insured, it's clear that it's a big liability to other people, it's a cost to other people if you have uninsured drivers all over the place. And that's understood. You have to force drivers to be insured because if not, you're imposing costs on other people when they have accidents. But the individual mandates seem different. We'll discuss that when we get to the healthcare section. So the first conclusion, which comes from the last lecture, is that if all you care about is negative freedom, markets aren't so bad. They do a pretty good job. However, even with respect to negative freedom, markets aren't perfect. There are ways in which markets have coercive aspects, even with respect to this crucial negative face of freedom. In particular, if you don't have assets, if you don't have wealth and you want to eat, you need to enter a labor market. That's especially the case if we had truly free markets with no government interference, that is, no safety net, no unemployment insurance, no welfare. You have to work, sell your labor for a wage to an employer. And once at work, you have to do what you're told or you're fired. For most workers, therefore, the workplace is a site of domination, of being coerced at the workplace. Workplaces are, broadly speaking, a site of unfreedom. You do what you're told, you're coerced. This is domination. But it is, of course, domination softened by the fact that workers can always quit their jobs. If the domination is too brutal, too harsh, you can quit. And that really is important. That does, in fact, distinguish capitalist labor markets from slavery. And, you know, on a slave plantation, the slaves can't quit. That's the big affront to freedom constituted by slavery. You can quit. But since for most people, the realistic alternative to one job is another job, in which you're still controlled by managers and employers, the freedom to quit a job does not mean the freedom to avoid domination. The freedom to quit jobs does not mean that you're free to avoid working in settings of domination. The conclusion, then, is in a society with highly unequal distribution of economic assets, the market itself can be coercive in the negative freedom sense by restricting alternative space, people's face, and this does constitute an abridgment of negative freedom. Nevertheless, I think on balance, one would say, markets are pretty good for negative freedom. For positive freedom, however, there's a bigger problem. Here, the freedom-depriving character of free markets is much clearer, since inherently people with different resources have different capacities to put their life plans into effect. Markets distribute positive freedom in highly unequal ways. Now, of course, one can cite many wonderful examples of rags to riches. This is part of the mythology of American society, that we are a society in which anybody can get rich if only they put their mind to it. Rags to riches. This is a bit like arguing that because some people escape from prison, and they are undoubtedly the people who are the cleverest and put the most effort into escaping. Because some people escape from prison, everyone else who doesn't escape is not actually in prison. They're not actually dominated and unfree, since it's possible to escape. Well, of course, that's a ludicrous argument. I think this same argument applies to the fabled rags to riches story. It is simply not the case that most people who are born extremely poor have a realistic possibility of acquiring real freedom, positive freedom, to the extent that someone who is born rich. If everyone started in the same position in society, if we really had starting gate equality, everybody started in the same point with the same assets, and the differences later in life were all the result of effort and choice, then perhaps we would say that a market under those conditions wouldn't violate positive freedom. But in fact, as we know, I mean, this is something we'll come to in the middle part of the course, most people who amass great fortunes begin already wealthy. It's really rare, it's a very unusual circumstance for somebody to be born poor and end up wealthy. Most people who end up extremely rich begin on third base, as it's called. They don't begin by simply raising themselves up by their own bootstraps. I think it's fair enough then to say that if we left markets just to their own devices, if we had no other institutions in the society to ensure greater positive freedom for people, we would live in a world in which the vast majority of people had extremely constrained positive freedom, and some people accumulated huge amounts of positive freedom. I say accumulate freedom, your capacity to act in the world. Okay, that's the moral issue around the critique of markets. It's the critique of free, unregulated markets. I want to just constantly iterate that because I'm not arguing for a society in which we abolish markets. I'm arguing for a society in which we create alternative institutions which compensate for the severe deficits that will be generated by markets alone. Deficits in human freedom, in this case, one of the core moral virtues of markets. We need other kinds of institutions to compensate for the deficits in freedom generated by markets themselves. But the big issue around markets is not the moral one. I think that's not really where most people defend a free market form of capitalism. The big issue centers around these pragmatic questions. The claim that unregulated free markets really deliver the goods, that they're efficient and they generate widespread prosperity. That's really where the argument in favor of unregulated markets comes, that they simply work better, and that regulations of all sorts make them work less well. Well, let's look then at a series of issues in markets in which markets create deep problems of inefficiency, where capitalist markets undermine efficiency rather than promote efficiency. Okay, we're going to look at a number of these. First, the problem of information. Faulty consumer information. Markets only allocate products efficiently if people have perfect information about what they buy. But this is often very difficult for consumers, especially because firms have tremendous incentives to distort information. Firms have incentives to hide information. I mean, how many commercials have you seen on television in which firms advertise the consumer complaints against their products? You know, you don't get repair records posted on comparative repair records of American cars compared to Japanese cars on American car advertisements, because Japanese cars have better repair records. Firms have incentives to hide information. Because of this, we have laws that require firms to behave in particular ways with respect to information. So we have laws prohibiting false advertising. You're not allowed to state out-and-out falsehoods about your products. You can come pretty close. You know, you can use all sorts of locutions that aren't exactly false but are deeply misleading. But you can't claim that that your product has been certified by the Federal Drug Administration as curing a particular disease if it isn't certified by the Federal Drug Administration as curing diseases. But you can say that your product promotes health and that many people have said that it improves your recovery from certain illnesses, even if there's no evidence whatsoever. You can say that. We require firms to provide certain kinds of information to consumers which they would not provide in a perfectly free market. Food labeling, I think, is the best example. That, you know, it's an example that everybody knows about. Why should we force firms to spend the extra resources? It increases their costs, after all, to have an accurate food label on a product. Why should we force them to do that if they don't want to? You know, it's their business. Why shouldn't they be able to sell you things without telling you how much sugar or how much saturated fat or how or whether it contains peanuts, right? When the requirement to include peanut warnings on food, that is to have on the label this product was made in a facility that also has tree nuts, the food industry objected to that. But if you're a parent and you have a child with a food allergy, the only way you can know that the food is completely safe for your child is to know what's in it. So we force companies to do that. We create penalties if they don't. It is illegal for them not to put accurate information on their food labels, and they're required to do so. In a perfectly free market, firms could make whatever claims they liked about their products. There'd be no restriction. You could make whatever claim. If consumers felt it was valuable for them to know the truth, then there would also be a market for good information about those firms. There would be product rating firms. And some of those would be very sophisticated and others would be crude. So you'd have really good product rating firms and really bad ones. And then you would probably get kind of consumer watchdog groups that would rate the product rating firms. So you'd have some confidence that if you're paying for the product ratings, you would get it from a reliable firm. Of course, firms wouldn't want to distort information too much because reputation does matter. There's some constraint on how bad the information of firms are. That's simply the result of consumer choices. But there would be an awful lot more distorted information in the market if there weren't rules prohibiting it. Of course, consumers could always sue corporations for fraud. That is, fraud would still be illegal. Fraud is illegal, but you'd have to sue the company for fraud because of the damage it caused you. Rather than having the government regulate the producers by enforcing regulations against misrepresentation. There have been arguments, for example, by Milton Friedman, that we really should eliminate licensing of doctors. Anybody should be able to put up a shingle and say that they're a doctor. And then you would have certification agencies. The American Medical Association would certify real doctors, and then you'd have quacks who would be uncertified by the American Medical Association. So they would create something called the United States Medical Association, which would certify them. And then consumers would need to know that they need to go to doctors that are certified by the American Medical Association, not by the American Society of Doctors or whatever other name. You would shift the burden for gathering information about the quality of doctors onto patients rather than onto government requirements for certification. Now the advantage then that free market advocates and libertarians argue for is that in an unregulated medical market, there would be much broader provision of cheap medicine for people who could only afford cheap medicine. You'd get less well-qualified doctors serving one segment of the population and highly qualified doctors serving another, but people would be free to choose how much they want to spend their money on their own health versus other things. Well, most people, even most libertarians, most people who are opposed to government regulation, most people are pretty uneasy with an unregulated market in brain surgeons, so to speak. Most people want to have at least a basic confidence that there is some authority which they trust that has certified the competence of someone who is going to treat you for serious health problems. An important example of this crucial issue about information is a very famous case around the Ford Pinto from the 1970s. Here's basically the problem. Because of a faulty placement of gas tanks, just the engineering design was bad, there was a tendency for the cars to explode under certain kinds of rear-end collisions. The cost of the change, that is if they were retrofitted to solve this problem, was roughly $11 a car. And Ford Motor Company knew this. Ford calculated that it was more profitable not to make the change, that it was more profitable for the Ford Company to settle in out of court with people who died in crashes because of exploding gas prices, in which the settlements were in the couple of $100,000 per case. It was better to spend a couple of $100,000 for each person killed who would bother suing in court than it was to make the $11 change throughout the industry. When there was government hearings about this, Ford's strategy was to obstruct accountability and fight regulation. The result is that the legislation to require higher quality safety standards was delayed from 1961 to 1966, and effective implementation of the regulation delayed until 1977. These delays were the result of deliberate lobbying effort by Ford Motor Company to constantly put obstacles in the way of raising safety standards. They claimed that the safety standards were a burden, that this would make American cars less competitive, all the usual kinds of things that are said about government regulation. And the result was that hundreds of lives were lost. This isn't ancient history. The same problems reoccurred in the 1990s in this sport utility vehicle rollovers. The auto companies denied any responsibility. They said it wasn't faulty design. And eventually, after an extended period of delay and debate over these issues, new safety standards for SUVs were created. And more recently, the airbag failures in certain models of Japanese cars, where the airbags, when they inflated, would also explode with shrapnel, so that the airbags were more dangerous than the accidents which triggered them. These are all cases where there are problems in the safety of cars, even in a world with pretty good safety regulation. Firms want to get around it, and when there's problems, they deny the existence of the problems and obstruct efforts to improve them. Imagine what it would be in a regulatory regime where we said, no, we don't want to have safety regulations on automobiles. It should be up to the corporations. There'll be highly rated, highly safe cars, and there'll be unsafe cars, and it's the consumer's responsibility to find out which cars are safe and which are not. That's what a unregulated free market would be like in automobiles. It would be a market in cars that would be much more dangerous than in the world today. Well, that's consumer information. And again, I want to just stress, this isn't a small sort of side problem. It's deep. It's an inherent deep problem in markets, that the sellers of products have way more information than the buyers, and they have all sorts of incentives to hide information, making it very costly and sometimes really impossible for consumers to know what they're buying. And without that perfect information, without having symmetrical information on both sides of the exchange, then there's no reason to believe that markets are allocating things efficiently. They're just not. They're inefficient. If this was just noise on the edges of the system, then one could say, okay, every system has a little bit of problems, but this is not noise on the end. It's noise at the heart of a market, not noise. It's a problem at the heart of a market. And the only way of solving it is rules. And rules which firms will experience as a burden. Because after all, if it wasn't a burden, you wouldn't need the rule. If it literally wasn't a burden, if it's something that was costless, then firms would do it anyway. It's not costless to provide good, transparent information to consumers. It's not costless. And that's why firms object to it. Okay, second issue. This is still the first issue. I see what I'm doing wrong. I am hitting, this is, I mean, you'd think that at this point in a career where I have been doing this for, I've been teaching for decades, I've been doing PowerPoint for, you know, nigh on 20 years at this point, you'd think I would realize which arrow to push to advance rather than reverse the sequence. All right. Concentrated economic power, sometimes called monopoly power. The word monopoly literally means one seller. Oligopoly means a few sellers. It's pretty rare to have only one seller in a market. There are cases where you're close to one seller. Mostly what we're talking about are just high concentrations of power in the market in large and powerful corporations that are oligopolies. few sellers. This information problem is made vastly worse when it's combined with concentrated economic power of corporations. That we saw in the case of the Ford Motor Company. The problem with the Ford Motor Company was that it had deep pockets, so it could obstruct in court all sorts of cases. It could hire fancy lawyers. It's very tough to sue corporations. The only effective way for people to sue corporations is to do what are called class action suits, in which thousands of people band together in the suit rather than each individual who feels harmed by a corporation suing the corporation themselves. Recently, the Supreme Court, in the name of having freer markets, has made it much more difficult to have class action suits. So if you feel you're harmed by a corporation, in many cases now, you have to individually sue the corporation. Well, there's an asymmetry of power in terms of the resources an individual can bring to bear in their suit against a corporation because of their ability to pay for a lawyer compared to the army of high-powered lawyers that corporations can hire. The premise of the defense of the virtues of the market is that people in firms really don't accumulate enough power in the market to control the market itself. Everyone enters into exchanges as individual, voluntary actors, freely making choices. No one has the kind of power in which they can impose their will on others. That's what power means. I mean, here's a concept, power. What do we mean by power? Well, if you want a concept which in sociology and other social sciences gets debated constantly because of its complexity, power is a good candidate. It's actually a pretty difficult concept to nail down. I think the simplest idea of power is that your ability to get your way even against the objections or resistance of others. Just think of it in this very simple way. Power is your ability to impose your will over others. So if I came to class and I said, look, I've got a stereo I want to sell for $100. Does anyone want to buy it? I have no power over you. Can't force you to buy the stereo. You can say yes or no. Many people believe that markets are the enemy of power, that markets are exactly that kind of social relation. Nobody has the power to force you to do anything. You can just make your choice. Well, it turns out that actually markets are arenas of power, not just arenas of voluntary bilateral exchange. It's an inherent feature of market dynamics that winners in competition will tend to become larger and larger. And when they become very large, they exercise real power in the market. Just think about Microsoft, Walmart, British Petroleum, Boeing, many other such corporations. They don't just make things and sell them on the market, they shape the market through their own actions. Whoops, not that. The large corporation is not just like a corner grocery store, but bigger. It has the ability to make strategic choices that massively affect the lives of communities, the choices they face and the kinds of lives they can lead. Microsoft has been notorious in this example. Because of its dominant position in producing operating systems for personal computers and various other devices, Microsoft is able to force you to buy things you don't want to buy by packaging all sorts of programs along with its operating system. It forces you to buy things you don't want to buy because of its control over the market. Walmart forces suppliers to squeeze their workers. Walmart doesn't just look for what the best products are for its stores. It creates contracts with suppliers where it forces them to adopt sweatshop conditions for their workers in order to meet the low-cost targets that Walmart insists upon. And those suppliers just don't have other choices because of the scale of Walmart in the retail business for a whole variety of goods. Gigantic financial institutions can engage in risky financial dealings that jeopardize the livelihoods of tens of millions of people and displace the risk onto others. Big tobacco, for decades, used its power to obstruct regulation of cigarettes. Even after they knew it was addictive from their own research and knew it was harmful. And yet they recruited scientists to testify in court cases and in public hearings that tobacco wasn't harmful. They did so knowing that they were distorting information, and they had the power to do it because of their wealth. We now know this is true of the sugar industry as well. That's a recent set of revelations about the role of the sugar industry in trying to discredit certain kinds of research that, from starting in the 1960s, that indicated the harmfulness of a diet that was laden with refined sugar. The oil industry's role in financing the climate denial movement, of financing the belief that global warming is not a problem, that it's not caused by human activity. That is not simply a set of beliefs that some people happen to have. It's a set of beliefs financed by the oil industry, which it's able to do because of its power. That's an exercise of power. Wrong arrow again. I think let's all just attribute this to my slow rehabilitation from my broken leg, that it has ramifications in my cognitive capacity to remember which arrow to push. All right, third source of market inefficiency, negative externality. Now, this is a really big idea, so you can put an asterisk in your notes, right? Flag this. I can guarantee you 100% you're going to be asked questions about negative externalities. So, on the exam. So, circle it, say, you've got to figure it out. Turns out to be, there's a lot of complexities in the idea of negative externalities. It'll take some work to really nail it down, even though the core idea is pretty simple. The core idea is simply that a negative externality is a negative side effect of an activity that affects other people, a negative effect on other people. That's a byproduct of what you're doing. Market efficiency depends on prices reflecting the true costs of producing things, right? That's when we discussed the idea of allocative efficiency. It had all to do with the way prices adjust to supply and demand, and ultimately settle down when supply and demand are in equilibrium in a way that makes prices very much in line with the costs of production. So if something costs more to produce, it costs more to sell. The price is higher. If it's cheaper to produce, the price is lower. So that's key to market efficiency. But firms often systematically displace costs and risks onto others in many ways. So the costs that they face in setting their prices are below the true costs of producing what they produce. And that's what a negative externality is. The basic idea here is the ability to impose costs and risks on others in many ways, and this is a fundamental problem in capitalist market economies, not a small second-order problem. So here's the basic way to think about this. The profits of a firm are basically the difference between the cost of producing something and the price they can get for them. The lower the costs, the higher the price. The higher the gap between price and cost, thus the higher the profits. If you're a smart capitalist, then you try to get other people to absorb some of your costs, to displace costs as much as possible onto others. This doesn't mean that capitalists who do this are evil people. The problem is not mainly a failure of integrity. The problem lies not in the integrity of actors, but in the institutions in which they make rational choices. The classic example of a negative externality is pollution. That's kind of the simplest, most straightforward example. We'll talk about that next week in a more refined way when we discuss the problem of the environment and the explanations for environmental problems of various sorts. But just think about it. If you're and there's good cases in Wisconsin. If you're a paper mill producer in Wisconsin, in the Fox Valley, and you have waste products from your paper mill, there's various things you can do. You can store them safely and remove the toxic chemicals from your waste products in a way that does not affect anyone. That's expensive. That raises the cost of production. Or you can dump it in Green Bay and in the Fox River and the various waterways of that region, which in the end were deeply polluted by the waste products from paper manufacturing. That made paper manufacturing in Wisconsin more competitive. It was cheaper to produce paper by virtue of the fact that you didn't have to dispose of the toxic materials from waste from paper manufacturing in a way that protected the environment. Protecting the environment imposes costs on producers, but it's imposing costs that reflect the true costs of production. And that's what is a requirement for markets to function efficiently. If the costs you face do not reflect the true cost of producing whatever it is you're producing, then your prices will be too low, and the equilibrium that's produced with supply and demand will not be efficient. It's really important to grasp that idea. If I'm selling something, I'm cheating in setting the price low to make it a competitive advantage if the reason I can set it low is because I forced other people to pay for part of my costs. And that's what dumping waste into the water means. You're forcing other people to bear the costs. They bear the costs either in the form of ill health, that's one way people bear the costs of pollution, or they bear the cost in the form of having to clean it up later. And the cleanup of the toxins from the paper industry in Wisconsin costs hundreds of millions of dollars. It's still ongoing. It's still a problem. It hasn't been resolved yet. So pollution is kind of the classic example. What are some other examples? So we'll do another one of our little 2-minute exercises, okay? So efficiently, turn to somebody next to you, everybody. Turn to somebody next to you. Give other examples besides pollution. Think of other examples in which you displace costs onto other people in order to increase your own profits. If your capitalist firms increase profits by displacing costs onto other people. What are examples other than pollution? You too, talk to each other. Oh, you got it, okay. All right, you're just quick on the draw. Okay. Okay, I was listening. It was kind of interesting. There was a sort of bell-shaped curve of the decibels from all of you, and I was hearing the conversations taper off, so that seems like a lot of you have come to some resolution. All right, examples, other examples. Negative externalities besides pollution. Yeah. Transportation. Yeah, that's a good example. We'll be discussing that in detail when we talk about public transportation. Public transportation will enable us to introduce a complementary concept to negative externality, that is positive externalities. People receive benefits from public transportation even if they don't use it. So that's a positive externality. But one can think of automobiles as having all sorts of negative externalities. That is negative effects in congestion if everybody drives, so that it takes longer to get to work if everybody drives, rather than people carpooling and so on. Other examples? Yeah?
Construction noise.
Construction noise, sure. That's a negative externality that affects people in the environment, and that's one of the reasons why if you have construction project, there are rules about what hours you can do it. You can't do it 24/7 because of, in some places, because of the negative effects on bystanders. One might call that noise pollution. Some people use that term, but it's a good example. Other examples? Yeah?
Sweatshop labor.
Sweatshop labor. Moving labor overseas does have negative externalities for the communities from which factories move.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. But one might want to ask, this is another interesting question, are there negative externalities in and of itself of sweatshop labor? That is, the expression sweatshop labor is used to describe really intense, highly exploitative labor situations. Now, that harms the people who are directly employed. But one might want to argue that it has negative effects on, as byproducts, on the environment as well. Yeah.
I said that too, and I said that like those people have to pay them for healthcare, like for themselves. Like,
that the people subjected to sweatshops have to have higher costs of other sorts because the employer doesn't have to consider the costs on the bodies and the health. Yeah. So that would be a nice way of putting it. That in addition to just not being paid well, the stress and harm of that kind of labor process imposes costs that are borne by those people in one way or another. And health costs would be another example. Some other ones, yeah. Sure, absolutely. So you produce products that have health consequences that are side effects of using the product, and it would cost more to prevent those side effects, so the manufacturer of those products is able to sell the products more cheaply. You know, again, that's lowering costs in order to sell more, but there are these hidden costs that are experienced by the users in the form of health risks down the road. Okay, those are all good examples. Let me elaborate a little bit on one example that was given. A firm, which is in the news a lot today, what happens when firms move from one place to another, when they close up in Milwaukee and go to Mexico, let's say. Because a firm moves because they will have a higher rate of profit in a different location. Now, in many instances, the firms that shut down in one place and moved to another were making positive profits in the first location. It's not that they were going out of business. It's not as if they couldn't make a profit. They just made higher profits by going somewhere else. What are the costs associated with that move? Well, one of the costs of firms moving out is a reduction in the value of homes. When you have an urban center that had large employment in certain sectors and those factories shut down and move elsewhere, home values decline. If the owner of the firm had to include the devaluation of home prices in the calculation of whether it was cheaper to move to Mexico or to stay, they wouldn't move. That is, the destruction of the home values of people in the community by virtue of the employment collapsing, that destruction is a cost of the decision to move from one place to another. But it's not a cost that any owner of a firm has to take into account. It's a cost that the residents of the community have to cope with, but it's not a cost that's faced by the employer. One way to think about this is the following. Suppose that the firm in question that moved from Milwaukee to Mexico, or whatever example you want to have, suppose it was owned by the employees of the firm and by the community, that there was some kind of ownership arrangement in which it was the owners of the firm were also the employees. Now, would the firm move to Mexico just because they could make a higher rate of profit in Mexico if it was owned by its employees in this situation? Well, the answer is obviously it wouldn't, because the employees would have to include in their calculation of costs the effects on their own home values. And the reason they would have to include it is because for them it's not an externality, it's an internality. It's a cost inside of the decision space. It's not just being displaced onto others. And that little exercise shows that it's the ownership relations of the firm that explains why it moves to a place where it can make higher profits. It's not simply the nature of the market and that it's more profitable to do it in one place or another. It's the ownership relations. And that's because the ownership relations determines what counts as an externality, a negative externality. I think that's the best way to, or one of the, an important dimension of the way to think about all of these debates about the movement of firms from one place to another. It's not that it's inherently a bad thing to move production to a lower cost part of the world. After all, you're providing jobs in parts of the world where jobs are scarce, and those are good jobs for people there. It's not inherently a bad thing to move from one place to another. It's only a bad thing to move from one place to another if it creates huge costs on people that are not compensated by the move, in which there's no mechanism inside of the market to solve that problem. And I, again, want to argue that this is intrinsic to the character of privately owned firms, that they have strong incentives. It's not just an accident. They have strong incentives to try to impose costs on others. All of these issues really have two kind of big implications. First of all, negative externalities really violates the value of fairness. It's unfair that I can impose risks on costs on you for my own benefit. That's just unfair. I think that's unfair by kind of ordinary standard notions of fairness. For me to benefit by imposing risks and costs on you without your permission, that is, without us agreeing, yes, this is a reasonable thing to do, for me to impose those costs on you is simply unfair. So it violates that value, which we haven't talked so much about yet. Negative externalities also violates freedom. I am coercively imposing costs on you without your voluntary consent. So negative externalities are inefficient. That's kind of obvious, because the costs aren't true costs of production. But they are also a violation of freedom. I am coercively imposing costs on you without your agreement. And that's a violation of negative freedom. And again, remember, negative freedom is the big, the big calling card of markets. It's what markets claim to provide in abundance. Well, negative externalities violate that value. Fourth source of market efficiency, inefficiency. Short time horizons. Short time horizons. The idea of a time horizon is a kind of interesting idea. It's something to just think about in all sorts of contexts. The idea of a time horizon refers to how far into the future do you take into consideration when you're making a choice. Short time horizons are sometimes called myopia, referring to vision problems, you know, short-sightedness. A short time horizon, sometimes people will say you're being myopic. The classic short time horizon problem is the kind of the cream puff problem. Well, eating one cream puff isn't going to cause me any harm. I'll just eat it. I'm not going to worry about the long-term consequences of always just asking, does this particular cream puff, how much of a difference is it going to make in my health? Well, no one cream puff causes you any real damage. But if you act on a very short time horizon, what's good or bad for me in the next 10 minutes, rather than what's good or bad for me over the next years, you'll end up with health problems. Weakness of will in people's dietary choices is a problem of short time horizons. Long time horizons are cases where you say, how do the choices we're making now, the decisions about what to produce, what to consume, how to organize our lives, how do these affect future generations? A very long time horizon says we should be making our choices not only to maximize the well-being of people right now, but of people in future generations. That's very long time horizons. Well, of course, it's a continuous idea. You can have time horizons that are quarterly. If you're a firm and you're always worried about what this stock market is going to think about you in the next 3 months, or you can have time horizons that take into account the next 4 or 5 years, five-year plans, strategic planning for corporations. Well, here's the big problem with markets and particularly highly competitive markets. Competition among profit-maximizing firms leads firms to have relatively short time horizons. They have to worry about the bottom line, not as it's averaged over the next 10 years, but as it's averaged over the next relatively short period of time. This imposes costs on future generations for our present production and consumption. You can think of this as an intergenerational negative externality. That's a kind of mouthful, an intergenerational negative externality. It's displacing costs onto the future. A lot of really serious environmental problems have that character. Drill, baby, drill is a short time horizon slogan for displacing costs onto future generations. It's a way of saying we want as cheap energy as we can possibly have now, irrespective of what costs that imposes on future generations. We will be focusing on this time horizon problem again in a more concentrated way when we discuss the environment next week. Source of market inefficiency number 5. Now, this is a topic that is going to spill over into the next lecture. This is really a two-lecture lecture that I'm giving. Let me just introduce it here, because this is another fairly complicated set of ideas. It also turns out to be the aspect of market inefficiency which most centrally involves the state or the government solving a problem, the idea of public goods. Let me make a terminological point. This came up in a comment that someone made to me after class. When I use the word the state, I'm not referring to states like Wisconsin or Kentucky. I'm referring to the whole apparatus of government at whatever level. So you can think of it broadly as national states. The term the state refers to the political machinery of government. In most parts of the world which have subnational units that have real political standing, most places they're called provinces. So you don't have that terminological confusion that we have in the United States. It's, of course, an interesting historical reason why we have this terminological confusion, and that's because when the colonies of the British Empire in North America revolted against the crown, they thought of themselves as sovereign states. And the formation of the United States was uniting all of these separate states. Kind of like what the EU does, the European Union does, although more successfully, by constituting a national state. But it was a national state based on states. So when I use the term state, I'm not referring to Wisconsin-type entities. All right, public goods. The source of market inefficiency is the under-provision of public goods. Well, what is a public good? A public good is a good or service which, if it is produced, provides benefits to people even if they don't pay for it. There's a lot of technical discussions about exactly what's public about a public good and various other little side conditions you have to put. I'm going to avoid that technical discussion. Let's keep it simple. This is really adequate for our purposes as a first approximation. It's very difficult to exclude people from the benefits of a public good. Take examples. Here's some examples. Public sanitation is a public good. If you have clean water and good sanitation, everyone benefits. Or national defense. We pay for national defense through taxes. But people who don't pay any taxes still benefit from national defense, right? Once it's made available, everybody benefits from it, regardless of whether you contributed taxes. Public goods are contrasted with private goods. A private good is a good in which all of the benefits are experienced by the person who pays for it. You know, think of a sandwich. When you eat the sandwich, it nourishes you. You get the benefits. Other people only maybe in a very weak way get the benefits because you're not so grouchy, because you're not so hungry. Then other people benefit from your eating the sandwich. There'd be some positive externalities of your eating the sandwich. Some goods are both public and private. Consider education. So all of you are reaping considerable benefits from being more educated. Your education is going to enable you to get better jobs than you would have if you weren't educated. But it's also true that everybody benefits from having a more educated population. An educated labor force benefits employers, whether or not they contributed to the education and training of the workers. Living in a society which is highly educated benefits everybody, even those who are less educated. It makes for better public policy. It makes for more considered judgments. It's better to live in a world of highly educated people than in a world of uneducated people. And that's the public good aspect of education. That's part of the justification for having taxpayers pay for part of your education, right? If it's a public good, then you shouldn't have to cover the full costs of your own education. Why should you pay for it all if part of the benefit of your education is benefiting other people? So those are public goods. And here's the problem, and a problem which we will discuss in depth why this is the case. In general, markets by themselves will not produce such public goods, or at least not produce enough of them of high enough quality, since people will generally benefit from the public good even without having to pay for it. Markets do a bad job in providing for public goods. And the private substitutes are often inferior to the public provision, precisely because they restrict the benefits. And we'll discuss why this is the case next Tuesday. See you then.